IB Biology Experience, where we discuss the intricacies, tips, and tricks for our course. Welcome to the very first episode of this podcast. Today, we will introduce a core concept in biology, cells. We will discuss some basic cell theory and cell origins, hopefully understanding what these things are. Then, we will talk about stem cells and some other details related to these topics. Today, it's just me talking to you guys. I've already had so many requests from students to come on, and that will commence shortly. But for now, I would like to say thank you to everyone joining the podcast. In all episodes, including this one, I'll be speaking without a script, but I will refer to some notes that I have written throughout. So what is basic cell theory? Basic cell theory are comprised of sort of three laws, and these are the unifying principles of biology. Number one, all living things are composed of cells. Number two, the cell is the smallest unit of life. Number three, cells only arise from pre-existing cells. An example of this is bacteria, which divide into half through the process of mitosis. There are, however, some exceptions to these theories. The first one is muscle fibers. Muscle fibers have multiple nuclei despite being surrounded by a single continuous plasma membrane. This concept challenges the idea that cells always function as autonomous units and that they are the smallest unit of life. Certain types of hyphae fungal or fungi are separated by walls called septa, but some are not separated by these cell walls, and therefore they have this continuous cell, this continuous cytoplasm. Cytoplasm is the fluid within the cell along the entire length of this hyphae, and this challenges the idea that living structures are composed of discrete and individual cells. There are some types of algae, known as giant algae, where the unicellular algae grow to extremely large sizes, considering that it's just one cell, to 7 centimeters. This challenges the idea that larger organisms are always made of many microscopic cells, and that cells are the smallest unit of life. Linking to the surface area and volume, which will be later discussed. So if you're not by now, you should be asking, where did these cells come from? You know, how did they originate? And this process of asking, what I've learned whilst learning biology is that the more inquisitive you are and the more willing you are to dig deeper into a topic, even if that means going beyond what you are required to know, you tend to be able to learn it more easily and retain the information, as you have in some way built up a personal connection with it that others may have not have, because you now understand more, and you may now understand the topic completely. There are many topics in our course which are not explained in totality, which sort of leave the student hanging, and I find that that hanging is places where I have had to go back and revise constantly. And when I have dug deeper, it's much easier for me to remember them. So I do suggest you do those. So the theory of cells originating is known as abiogenesis. So this theory suggests that all cells were formed from non-living matter. So all these cells were formed by non-living matter somehow forming into cells. And then, as we learned earlier, that all cells are derived from pre-existing cells. So these, how were the first cells formed is really the question, you know, understanding that cells were formed from pre-existing cells is doable. You know, cells divide and they form into more cells. But how did we get these first cells? So Stanley Miller and Haoru Yue recreated conditions of the prebiotic Earth using a closed system of flasks and tubes. This experiment was in fact performed in the 1950s, where water was boiled to vapor, reflecting the high temperatures common to that period's conditions on Earth. This vapor was mixed with a variety of gases, which are also very common then, hydrogen, methane, ammonia, creating a reducing atmosphere where no oxygen was present. You must remember, no oxygen present. How is life formed? This is how life is formed. This mixture was then exposed to an electrical discharge, somewhat stimulating the effects of lightning as an energy source for these reactions that may have occurred. Remember, this is just a theory. This mixture was then allowed to cool off, allowing the components to actually concentrate together, and it was left for a period of 1 week. After this time, the condensed mixture was analyzed and found to contain traces of simple organic molecules. So these simple organic molecules are really referred to as monomers, you know, single, just one individual molecules. But it is suggested and thought that these single molecules then went ahead and formed polymolecules or polymers, poly indicating many. And then some of those polymolecules, not all of them polymolecules, went ahead and replicated into more organisms and cells. And there we have it. You know, those are now the... A lot will come up that cells came from pre-existing cells. So if you can remember this reaction or this experiment as creating those pre-existing cells, it's sort of like the chicken and the egg. You know, what came first or how did one come about? And this theory may not be perfect. There is some criticism related to it, a very strong criticism, which is that the electrical charge was constant throughout. And this was really not the case of prebiotic Earth. There was no constant electrical charge in prebiotic Earth, but this experiment had a constant charge. Therefore, it is best that we just realize that this is a theory. It's the best theory we have, and it hasn't been disproven. We have had theories disproven in the past, but it's not, nor has it been proven. So we'll leave it just as a theory. So now we should link back to the cell principles, where pre-existing cells form, so all cells are derived from pre-existing cells. So this abiogenesis no longer occurs, but what occurs is called biogenesis. And this is where new cells are formed, and cells are formed today in Earth's current conditions. Because cells cannot be formed using abiogenesis due to the change in the Earth's atmosphere. This process is proved by the Pasteur experiment, where broths were stored in vessels that contained long tubings that did not allow for external dust particles to pass into. The broths were boiled to kill off any microorganisms present in the growth, medium, so just to make sure that there was nothing that could, there was nothing inside except for the broth. There's nothing living. And then growth only occurred in the broth if the flask was broken or open, which meant that it allowed it to be contaminated from external environment. From this, it is concluded that the bacterial growth came from external contaminants and does not occur spontaneously. It doesn't just happen out of anywhere. It happens due to pre-existing cells differentiating or dividing to create new cells. So, you know, this is great. We know how cells are formed. We know some basic cells' laws. But what do cells really do? So, cells carry out all the essential functions to our life. And our course defines them as the following. Metabolism, which is when living things undertake essential chemical reactions. Reproduction, where we reproduce offspring. either sexually or asexually. Sensitivity, where we respond to internal and external stimuli. Homeostasis, where living things maintain a stable internal environment. Excretion, living things exhibit the removal of waste products. Nutrition, where exchange materials within the body and with the environment. And finally, growth, where living things can move, change shape, or size. So these eight things are really essential to this course. You will notice that every topic is built off these things. So it's important that you remember them. It also comes up a lot for multiple choice questions. It is an easy multiple choice question, but people do get it wrong. So you can remember this process or these functions as Mr. Sheng. So M for metabolism, R for reproduction, S for sensitivity, H for homeostasis, E for excretion, N for nutrition, and G for growth. So I maybe I've said unicellular organisms a few times today, so I'll just clarify what they are. Unicellular organisms are organisms which only contain one cell. These include bacteria or algae. Within this one cell, the bacteria carries out all its functions and all its processes to sustain life. Now, obviously, these would be very limited as you're made up of one cell. What happens in multicellular organisms like ourselves, animals, plants, is that certain groups of cells can go ahead and focus on specific things, as this allows for synergistic processes to be carried out by the organism. So what I mean by this is that, you know, we have cells. Then cells can be grouped together to form tissues. And then organs are then formed by the functional grouping of multiple tissues. Organs then interact with the whole body, forming organ systems. And organ systems collectively carry out life functions to complete the organism. So if we think about this in the human body, this is a good example. So we have muscle. And then we have, you know, muscle cells. Then we've got a group of muscle cells coming together to form the cardiac muscle. Then we have cardiac muscles forming the heart. Then this heart is an organ. Then the heart in our body is like a system, right? It's a blood system. It pumps blood from, gets deoxygenated blood pumped into it and pumps out oxygenated blood to the rest of the body. And this process is reoccurring. It's like a system. And therefore, that is the vascular system. And this vascular system, along with other systems within our body, make up the entire organism, or are human. So, well, how do cells then go about, multicellular organisms? We've understood that certain cells have certain functions, and then those certain functions can group together to form bigger groups and bigger groups and bigger groups, and linking it to then the person. But, you know, there are some cells which are involved in the growth of hair. There are some cells for skins. There are some cells for muscles. So how do these cells differentiate and specialize into their own specific function? So all our cells, in fact, we will learn in more detail about this, but all our cells contain the same genetic information. And by genetic information, you may have heard of it, but it's essentially our DNA. So this point is very important, indicating that, see, all the cells at the start were the same, but they then all slowly differentiated and then were specialized into specific functions. So how did this process of specialization occur? So what happened is that certain cells or a group of cells expressed only a particular section, a specific section of their genetic information, which then undergoed a process called protein synthesis. We will learn about protein synthesis, so just wait. To create specific proteins to that specialized process. So this has to do with how this is also a bit of an extension on this part, but I believe it's vital for your understanding, which is that we have the DNA stored in stored around something called, and it's tightly packed proteins, which are known as histones, and this forms something called the chromatin. So when I mean certain genetic information is expressed, where, you know, it's expressed and then that is synthesized into proteins, and then those proteins specific to a particular function, what happens is that through some other biological processes, the gene becomes active and is readable. But when it is inactive, it is unreadable. And that cell does not produce those things and is not specialized for the things which are unreadable. So once this process occurs, a cell can't go back. It loses its ability to specialize into something else. So a cell which produces blood cannot produce hair. A cell which is a muscle cell cannot become a cell in the eye. It can't not become a retina cell. It just cannot. Because once this process of specialization has occurred, the cell has already formed into something else. So there are some cells, and you definitely have heard about them, stem cells. So these are cells which have the ability to continuously divide and replicate, and they have potency, meaning that they have the capacity to differentiate into specialized cell types, meaning that a stem cell can become a cell in the brain, a stem cell can become a cell in the hair, and a stem cell can become any cell, can become anything. You can regrow full hands with stem cells. You can do anything. But, you know, there is a process to it, and we will get to that. So there are four main types of stem cells at various stages of human development. So there are totipotent cells, which come first. These are any cell type, as well as extra embryonic cells, and they can differentiate into anything. Then we have pluripotent, which are, they can also form anything, and these are embryonic stem cells, cells within the embryo inside the mother's womb. Then we have multipotent stem cells, which can differentiate into closely related cells. So like the heme adult stem cell. And then we have unipotent, which cannot differentiate, but are capable of self-renewal. So these are muscle cells, hair cells, and blood bone marrow cells. So, you know, what are the, you know, you've understood that the use of this stem cell is so that it can differentiate into any cell it wants. But how can we, you know, our course talks about how we can utilize that for certain diseases. So what we do is that we trigger the differentiation of stem cells into what we want it to be, and then we surgically implant those differentiating stem cells into the patient's own tissue. And then we have to suppress that person's immune system because they begin rejecting foreign cells. So it can be a dangerous situation where somebody's immune system cannot fight off other diseases, but it is a price to pay. And then, you know, we monitor that these cells don't become cancerous, because cancerous means that these are dividing uncontrollably. And you know, stem cells don't necessarily divide uncontrollably, but stem cells are made to divide. So the two important diseases which you're required to know, and even if you're not doing the course and you're listening in, which are very important, are Stargardt's disease. So this is an inherited disease which degenerates your vision and causes people to become blind. So it's terrible, terrible disease. But it's caused by a gene mutation that impairs energy transport to retinal photoreceptors, causing them to degenerate. So what we can do is we can treat this through the process which I just read out to you. We can replace these dead cells in the retina with functioning ones derived from stem cells. So we can divide those stem cells into the photoreceptor cells, put them in the eyes, you know, suppress your immune response, and then you have vision, hopefully. Another important one is Parkinson's disease. So in fact, my grandfather has this disease. and we haven't been able to do stem cell treatment. But Parkinson's disease is another degenerate disorder of the central nervous system, and it's where, you know, the dopamine secreting cells in the brain no longer function. So you don't, it doesn't secrete any more dopamine. And this is a neurotransmitter responsible for transmitting signals in everything, you know, walking, laughter, you know, purposeful movements, everything. What you want to do, you know, he cannot do them. My grandfather cannot do what he wants to do. He can think about it. You know, he knows everything, but he cannot do things because he has no dopamine. And then what happens is that patients exhibit tremors, rigidity, slowness of movement, and postural instability. And this is exactly what happens to my grandfather. But it can be treated, again, by stem cells. What a great invention. By replacing those dead nerve cells with living dopamine-producing ones by you know, differentiating those stem cells. So, you know, continuing on stem cells, what's important to discuss is the ethics of stem cells. I've seen this come up in many exam questions whilst practicing, and it's an interesting topic, most definitely is, but I think we'll keep it concise. So, we use stem cells that can effectively differentiate into anything, and realistically, those are pluripotent stem cells, what I'd read out to you earlier. You know, the ability to differentiate into any cell type. But these can only be found from the embryo or the umbilical cord's blood from a newborn baby. The ethical problem arises from the use of embryonic stem cells as they require the destruction of a potential living organism. So, a baby may not be born due to the use of embryonic stem cells because you have to extract the stem cells, and that will cause the embryonic cell to die. Additionally, there is a heightened cost to storing the stem cells from baby's blood, so we may not want to use those as they are costly. What you may have also remembered is that we do have stem cells already also within our, you know, fully differentiated individual. Those are your bone marrow, your hair, and your skin. But these stem cells are unipotent, and they can only develop into those same things. However, to combat, you know, that problem, science has come up with a great way where we can use already differentiated cells as stem cells by essentially, you know, turning back their clock through this process known as nuclear reprogramming, whereby the stem cell is reprogrammed back to its pluripotent form, allowing it to be differentiated into anything. How amazing is that? Some other things that I want to touch on for the 1.1 and the 1.5 syllabus dot points are the surface area to volume ratio. So through metabolism, as I said previously, you know, these are really relevant to our course, the Mr. Sheng acronym. So cells, you know, need to produce chemical energy to survive and to undergo exchange of materials within the environment and within the body. So this, the rate of metabolism is actually a function of the cell's volume, and it's also a function of the cell's surface area. So the larger the cell, the smaller the surface area, meaning the smaller area it has to diffuse and to have intake into the cell. So there's something called the metabolic rate. And if that exceeds the rate of exchange of vital materials and wastes, you know, if we have a low surface area to volume ratio, meaning that we have a very large cell, therefore the surface area is decreased, the cell will eventually die, because it does not have the ability to exchange materials at a required rate. Therefore, cells which are growing tend to divide and remain in small, you know, small form. So like, those cells include your muscle cells, your skin cells, your blood cells. They're all very, very small. But some cells which don't, surprisingly, are the giant algae, which I talked about as well. So those somehow are exceptions to biology, and we still haven't worked them out. So there are some tissues and cells which have very, very large surface areas for specific reasons, and those include the intestine, where we must absorb all those proteins and fats which we digest. So those are things called villi, and villi are very, very long, and they have a ruffled structure to increase the surface area of the inner lining of the intestine to allow for more absorption to take place. It's also very, very common in exam questions, you know, when you're talking about the kidney or if you're talking about the process of digestion, to mention that an increased surface area by specific changes to a cell, you know, by making a villi or by making an intestinal cell, which are villi's, into specific shapes, that in fact increases the surface area and does the body benefit by increasing the rate of materials exchanged. This is also seen in the lungs, in the microvilli, where, you know, we exchange oxygen. So this is very, very important when we need a constant and high rate of exchange to take place. The last thing I'd like to add for today's podcast is the magnification. This is not for people who are just listening in. This is for people really specific to our IB biology course. Magnification is equal to the image size, the thing that you will measure with a ruler on your test, divided by the actual size. And it will, usually what happens is the actual size will be given to you in the description of the question. And obviously you can go ahead and rearrange this formula for actual size or image size if that is the case. I have only ever seen questions where it asked me to calculate the magnification. So image size, which you measured, over the size which they gave you in the question. You may be asked about something to do with light microscopes, but it is interesting to know. These are used to investigate the structure of cells and tissues, as it really magnifies the photo. Though you do have to, these are not living anymore. These are required to be killed in order to see it. If you are learning from this podcast and hopefully enjoying it, thank you. In the coming days, this podcast will be available on different podcast hosting apps, like Apple Podcasts, on which you can leave comments and ratings. In the meantime, you can simply tell me in person. I would love to hear how I can improve. Please subscribe to the podcast on Spotify and Apple. Thank you.